Hello and welcome to Hindsight here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam. Thanks for joining me today. Bogong is a Yimatong word, and it translates roughly as big fella. It's the name given to the huge mountain that towers over Victoria's beautiful alpine country. The Yimatong and neighbouring clans like the Dutaroa and the Wiradjuri still live in that country today. Their languages are used as place names like the Kiwa and Mitamita rivers, and towns like Omeo and Corryong. In 1887, huge tracts of this high country were given over as leases to cattlemen as additional summer grazing land for their sheep and cattle. In today's program, Ros Blewett takes a pack horse trip across these unique high tops and delves into archives of three past journeys, charting the changes in and the magic pull of this unique alpine region.
I'd always been fascinated by Victoria's Bogong High Plains. Just the name conjures a windswept wildness, a bygone era of horses, cattlemen, and remote settlements. And from old photos, it's still pretty much the same, except that the cattle have now gone. So I signed up for a four-day horse trek through this rugged alpine region. I then discovered that the late Norwegian artist Tor Holt was bewitched by the same mountains 30 years ago, at a time when cattle were still grazing there. Later I discovered botanist Maisie Fawcett, who was sent to the area in the 1940s on behalf of the proposed Kiwa Dam project. And then there's Jack McNamara. Jack, now aged 86, is one of the last of the great McNamara family to have grazed cattle on the High Plains. All three, Tor, Maisie and Jack, have tramped Victoria's high country. And despite being decades apart and with different purpose, all have witnessed profound change and experienced Mount Bogong's magic pull. Here's their story.
I'm Jack McNamara. I was born in Omeo in 1928. The McNamaras, early in their days, bred horses for the Indian Army. You know, the early 1900s and such like, that the horses were in great demand for the armies and various other things, and they went into horse breeding. They had cattle as well. There was three Jack Macs living at the same time, which I was one of. And there was old Jack, or old Johnny, who was known throughout the district. And then there was my father, they used to call him Young Jack. And then there was me, and they used to call me Little Jack, or Jackie. So that's how they distinguished us. Charlie Mack, he's my uncle.
Over 30 years ago, Norwegian Tor Holt met Jack's uncle, Charlie. Tor became fascinated by the life of the cattleman. In 1981, he decided to record his trip onto the High Plains to sketch their old huts and to see if 74-year-old Charlie Mack was still up there.
I wanted to do a series of paintings based on the region of the Bogong High Plains. I'd seen photographs of it. I'd had a couple of trips up there. And then I saw the huts.
Come on, fella.
Then I thought I'd like to record the huts. Then I wanted to meet the cattleman who built the huts.
Come on.
Get up.
I'd already spent about 4 months on my own up here.
All right.
And I suppose altogether, about 4,800 to 900 miles on horseback with pack horses.
And our 21st century group is being led by Clay Baird, a local whose family has taken on the business of leading tourists across the Bogong High Plains, the old-fashioned way.
So we've got 18 horses loaded up here. We've got six pack horses with us today, and they're carrying all the supplies that we'll need for the next 4 days. We're heading off into the mountains here, and if you have a look over here, there's Mount Feathertop. So today we're going to ride along the base of Mount Feathertop up the West Kiwa And then tomorrow we're going to jump up the back of Western Spur, ride out across the high plains, over Mount Fainter, down to Bogong Jacks, and then back safely into the valley here.
One that you've packed before and fairly high in the willows. There are many places up in the high plains which are completely inaccessible to cars. You can walk there, but you certainly can't carry enough gear to stay up there for a month or two. So you have to use horses. The advantage of horses is that you can cover a lot more ground. And a pack horse can carry up to 200 pounds on his back.
Yeah, well, fella already like that back in work again.
All right, so we'll pack him.
Yes, look what you want.
I was about 14. My father and old Jack Mack, they took me out and gave me a look at the high plains, and you know, we rode all over the high tops. That was my first trip out there. After that, of course, I went out with my father with cattle, and our own cattle, and took them out onto the plains. Took them up in summertime, in around about November. In the summer months, for the 3 or 4 months, they ran on the high country.
So the summer mountains was basically an extension of their pasture.
And the vastness of the area, coupled with the extreme conditions, even in summer months, forced the graziers to erect small wooden huts throughout the mountains.
The mountain cattlemen's huts have been used over many years for many different reasons. They were built for the autumn musters and to provide shelter through storms, bad weather, and in modern days they've been used as refuge for people to visit for the history and the cattlemen and the stories that go with it.
Blair's hut in Snake Valley is probably one of my favourite huts on the high plains. Nestled among them, enormous tall woolly butts and a creek only running about 15-20 feet away from it, right past the front door. It's one of those huts I want to draw this time.
My grandfather, he remembers as a young boy walking out onto Feathertop and visiting the huts. And my father, when he was a young man, Bob took him back to a lot of the same places. And in some regards, it's the same for me.
Got that cotton? Not really. All that you see here is the Bogong High Plains of Victoria. The roof of Victoria. The area about 2,500 square miles, not quite as much, isn't it? And in the early days, there used to be up to several thousand head of cattle scattered over this entire area. And at mustering time, you'd have the people coming up from the Kiwa, the Mitamita, the Ovens, the Tambo Valley over there, and the Omeo side. They'd all be coming up their trails with pack horses with their tucker, spare working horses, and go to their huts. They'd camp there, anything up to a month sometimes, depending on the number of cattle they had.
Well, when I first went up there, there was about 8,000 to 10,000 cattle going up every year. Come down in the winter, they'd have a big muster in early April, and they'd all the cattlemen would gather up there and ride all the ranges down the sides off the high country and bring their cattle up, and then they'd cut them out on what they call Pretty Valley cut-out grounds, and they'd all go their own ways then. There'd be a lot of yarning going on, particularly among the older folks. The young people like me didn't get into it very much.
That was in the 1950s, when Jack would have been in his early 20s. The cattlemen carved out tracks that are now used by bushwalkers and groups like ours, and tore halts in 1981. But sometimes they simply vanish into the spur of a mountain.
When we first went up, we used maps a lot. We took them with us and followed the trails, but after the first few weeks, we gave it away because instead we rode all the spurs and the ridges, the tops, and looked down so you have an overall picture of what it looks like down below. So in the end, we never followed any tracks or trails or snow lines. We just rode cross-country from hut to hut, and pretty well, if you didn't hit the hut the first time, you just poke around, you know it's in that area somewhere.
My father and I, when he got the runs up there, we were in a tent for a while and we got snowed in one year in this tent for 3 or 4 days. And he said, well, we'll have a hut here next year. So we built the log hut and then we used to stay in that. We built it in 1944, summer 1944-45. It was a hut about 12 by 10 and it was built of logs. It had a wooden floor on it, a paling floor, and it was all tamped up the spaces between the logs. And it was a lovely, cosy little hut, beautiful little hut. Big fireplace, and we did all our cooking on it. Better than the tent, particularly when you'd been snowed in one.
It's a chock and log construction. Internal chimney, dog leg fencing all around, a yard to keep the horses in. Oh, it's a lovely hut. I've often sheltered there, and the cattlemen use it frequently when they take the cattle up to the high country and then bring it down again past the lake spur down to Blair's Hutton and home. Seen a lot of action too, that hut.
So as we climbed yesterday up Western Spur, you might have noticed that the trees changed very rapidly after Blair's Hut and we turned into single species forest. So they were the woolly butts or the mountain ash, and they grow where there's regular snowfall, and as you sort of climb a little bit higher and you get to more permanent snow cover, then the snow gums start to take over and they start quite tall and straight, and as you climb up to the more exposed areas they become smaller and twisted and tormented trees that grow in some of the harshest environments.
These mountains are so different from the mountains that one sees in Europe or the Far East. As an artist, I found that I had completely changed my palette in painting when I tried to paint the Bogong High Plains. And when I saw these mountains, I had to adapt to the mountains. And I found, I think, a greater love for these high plains that I've found in Europe. You can walk for days and not meet a soul.
So it would have been a rather foreboding environment for a young woman in the 1940s. With the few trained male ecologists away at war, botanist Maisie Fawcett was given the job of investigating soil erosion in the Bogong catchment area, prior to the construction of the mighty Kiwa hydroelectric scheme. Jack McNamara remembers her arrival in the district. Botanical historian Lyndon Gilbank puts herself in Maisie's boots.
I mean, I can't imagine how difficult it would have been for her to start with. She's a scientist, she's female and single. She's working for the Soil Conservation Board. And you can imagine, you know, cattleman's remote outpost. You know, it rained all the time, her clothes get torn. She had trouble finding somewhere to repair her boots. I think it would have been very difficult for her. She came from Footscray. She wasn't even from the right side of the Yarra, for crying out loud.
Yes, I remember Maisie. Well, I remember going to Omeo, or being in Omeo, and in fact I used to take her around to various parts of the bush and let her have a look at this and that and various other things?
She had to do a lot of pleading and cajoling before the cattlemen agreed to take her up at mustering time.
She had to loan my great-uncle Ned's horse all the time she was in Omeo. She used to come out home and want to go and look at certain areas, and I'd take her out to them.
I know she went up there in 43, and that's when she starts talking about clues. I think she called it incipient soil erosion. She became aware of soil erosion in the tops. Now, that's the phrase they used for going up to the high plains.
So I was only a young chap then when I say that, but she was very nice to us young people. Very interesting. She was there as a conservationist, and she was doing work for the soil conservation people at the time. And that was a job, just looking in to see what was causing erosion and various other things and degrading the land and various things like that. It was just something that more or less they had only just started. That was back in the 40s, about 44, 45, something like that.
By 44, when he took her up, she was definitely aware of the problem of soil erosion, of grazing as a possible cause of erosion. But I'm not sure she would have had in front of mind, all right, it's definitely the cattle and I'm going to show it. I think what she had in mind was, how do we show, this is the proper scientific approach, how can we show whether grazing is influencing soil erosion?
At the time, cattle had been grazing the high tops for over 50 years. Maisie's job was to find a way of negotiating access with the many leaseholding cattle families and then measuring the impact of their herds on the land.
All the cattle families from around this area had a lease of a particular area of the mountains. So the cattlemen's huts that we've passed as we've ridden up have belonged to different cattle families over many generations, and they used to use them as a base either to salt the cattle or to muster in the autumn or spring. And the salt was a way that they used to use to keep the cattle in their lease, because the ground up here is naturally deficient in salt and the cattle crave it. So you can still see some areas that we'll pass later today where there's areas of big flat rock. And that's where they used to spread the salt out, and the cattle would come in and stay within their lease.
You'd go out and call the cattle, call salt, salt. And they knew everything about it. Cattle had and sheep for that matter, and horses loved salt. It'd be about 3 or 4 days doing it. And you'd hear them, and the cattle that were way down the sides off the level country or plain country, where, they'd work their way up just to get this salt. And so you'd probably salt them all and then kept them quiet, and they'd bring all these cattle up onto the Bogong High Plains, Pretty Valley.
Maisie Fawcett determined a particular area, which you could call a plot, right on the shoulder of Pretty Valley, and an equivalent plot of a similar type of vegetation outside the exclosure. And she did this for each type of vegetation so that you can compare the changes that occur in the vegetation and the soils in the area that from which you've excluded cattle with the area in which cattle continue to graze. An area that was grassy herb fields. This experimental setup was quite novel, but it was certainly not common. So in a way, she's at the forefront. It sort of shines as a sort of beacon in the front of ecology.
And she used to get about everywhere and here, there and everywhere. She's always on the move. You know, what we all knew what she was looking for. Yet I suppose I was a young fellow then. I didn't probably take as much notice of it, but the talk was that, you know, that they weren't very happy about it. And, but she's a very interesting person, and, you know, she'd be showing you things when she's in the bush all about different plants and that. She'd like to go to different places, and we were the people that were the handy, so she'd ask us if we'd mind taking her, well, just, you know, through the bush to where she wanted to go. I was about, I suppose, 16 or 17. Maybe a bit younger, I don't know.
The Pretty Valley acres, one fenced and one beside it that wasn't fenced, showed differences, huge differences, very, very quickly. Within a couple of years, I think, a couple of summers, you could see that within the fenced acre, the prettiness was returning to Pretty Valley. Lots of daisies were coming up. You know, beautiful. It was like a floral garden. So the Pretty Valley acre exclosure showed very, very quickly that if you exclude cattle, a whole lot of plants are able to regenerate.
When I'm up here, I feel as though I've never been away. And you recognise certain rocks, certain trees. There used to be certain bunches of flowers in a little hollow in there. You come across a ridge, perhaps. You notice that they're not there this time. They're somewhere else. I love the sounds in the morning, the trees, you know, rustling with the wind.
There's some amazing animals and some amazing plants up here too. The sphagnum moss is very important up here, and it's what creates all of those wet areas. We avoid that wherever possible. It's quite fragile.
The last thing you want is the snow to melt and all rush down at one time, or the rain to fall and to all rush down at one time. What you need is like a sponge, and the sphagnum bogs are brilliant at that. And that's why once you had cattle and horses clambering all over these sphagnum bogs, you're in effect degrading the vegetation and making the work of that whole landscape or those various ecosystems much more difficult to conserve water.
There's also habitats for the mountain pygmy possums. There used to be emu up here as well. I haven't seen them for a long time. And as well with brumbies. So there's quite a few brumbies up here. We've actually got a couple of brumbies on this trip that were trapped from national parks. Mac was trapped off the high plains here, and he's named after Charlie McNamara, who was a renowned brumby runner in these parts.
Well, the McNamaras, along with other people up in that high country, bred horses, and they were bred for the remounts for the Indian Army and I suppose other armies as well. And they used to run them in the high country, and then some of them got away, they just didn't muster them and didn't find them and over the years, and they became the wild horses or brumbies. They've multiplied now and they're coming right down into the lowlands. They'd certainly overgrazed the country because horses never stop eating, where cattle lay down and things like that, and sheep will have a rest, but horses eat, eat, eat all the time.
National parks have been undergoing a passive trapping program, and it certainly is with salt again, but what they use is portable trap yards, and they salt them in and out for a number of months. And when they get used to coming in and out, then they'll set a trip wire, and that way they catch family groups, so it's a lot less stressful for the animals.
You're listening to Hindsight on RN, and today we're on the High Alps of Victoria, on horseback, walking the old cattle trails. But now with the cows gone, two major issues of concern are brumby numbers and fire. Clay Baird first explored the area in the 1980s.
When I was a kid growing up through here, all of this was green, the trees were green, and now it's this sort of barren moonscape of silver trees and the fog, and it's an amazing sight up here. So a lot of these trees, the actual organism is still alive, but there's all of this dead wood. And if you have a look at some really old snow gums that are still alive, they'll have these sort of twisted structures, and the internal parts, there'll be dead wood that's still there, and then it's been sort of reclaimed by the living tree. So maybe in another 100 years or so, these trees will be encased in new snow gums again.
The clever snow gum grows from this sort of lignotuber in the ground. And so if you go up now, you see large areas of these, I think, quite beautiful skeletons, especially when the sun is low. But below the dead branches, the white skeletons, you see this green of the new growth because they're adapted to growing after fire, admittedly very slowly. There's a sort of ripple effect. The results that came from Maisie's plots could then be used to influence other conversations, other discussions.
Oh, God, look at Feathertop.
Feathertop seems to just grow taller and taller and taller. And Feathertop, though it's not the highest mountain in Victoria, it's the most dramatic-looking mountain. And I think it's called Feathertop because sometimes it's teased by clouds along the ridge or perhaps the late snow in autumn.
I love the cloud. It really brings this sort of mystic atmosphere when you ride through the clouds. And you always get, you know, 15 minutes where the fog clears and you get a glimpse at the view, and that's quite often enough.
Yeah. So is this, this morning we woke up and it was frosty.
A bit of frost is pretty normal up here. I was up here 2 years ago on the 11th of January. And it was horrendous, probably about 90 to 100 kilometre winds and snowstorms. And it was so bad, the horses just refused to walk. They just turned their bums into the wind and said, let's just wait it out here.
Well, the day before we got snowed in was a perfectly clear day, not a cloud in the sky. And we set up camp there and getting ready to get out next morning to start rounding up cattle and take cattle that are not ours out onto the Bogong. 2 o'clock in the morning, I woke up, I hear this bang, 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 thump, thump. My father knocking the snow off the roof of the tent, or the fly of the tent. And that's just how quick the weather comes up. We were there about 3 days before we could get out. Late March it was. 1943.
Remember the time coming across Pretty Valley, and it started with rain, that turned to sleet, hail, sleet, snow, and by the time I got on top of Mount Mackay, I was heading for Tawonga Hut, leading one horse and riding another. I rode into a blizzard and a complete whiteout. I was petrified. I couldn't even see the pommel of my saddle.
Yes, fogs come up and get caught. And it's not a very nice feeling when you can hardly see the horse's ears. Very thick fogs. And the only thing you do is you give your horse his head and let him take you home. Back to the base. Oh, they'd take you home. Of course they did, yes. No worries at all.
Today we're going to climb pretty steadily this morning up onto the bluff of Mount Fainter. We're going to tie the pack horses up. We're going to go for a nice long canter up to the bluff. It's a nice rolling hill, and you sort of canter up and the valley sort of falls away in front of you, and you're left with 360 degree views. And then we'll sort of descend down again a little bit off the bluff. And just below that, as we start to wind down the packhorse trail, Bogong Jacks is a nice secluded little camp with beautiful timber yards, historic yards, and it sort of appears in the saddle below us as we sort of meander down.
That's where you used to travel, up the main spurs to get onto the Bogong High Plains. And Charlie McNamara's hut, or the hut, the old Jack's hut, was between the Kabunga River and the Bundar River, built in about 1917.
The first time I saw one of these huts, oh, it was a delightful experience. It was dripping and misty. We came out of the scrub, and there in that little clearing was a gorgeous little log hut. And the door creaked as we opened it, and there's an enormous fireplace, and there were billies upended on the mantelpiece, and there were stumps to sit on and bunks to lie on, hard as rocks. But God, it was cozy. And, well, I was hung on them from then on. I wonder if Charlie Mack's up at the hut now. It's got a fantastic view, though, as we come up that spur and look back down through the valley.
Charlie Mack's hut, we were snowed in there, and that'd be about 1950-51. But at that time, there was old Jack Mack, my great-uncle Mick Mack, Charlie Mack, his son Peter Mack, and myself, all Macks, who were all together at that stage. We were there for about 3 or 4 days. And the reason we were there, we were going to shift cattle from Mack's dinner plain paddock, about 40 or 50 head of cattle, and we were going over there to take them out and shifting me down to lower land. But we got snowed in, and then there was a break in the weather. So we saddled up and took off and went across. And when we got up to the top of what they call Slippery Pinch, which would have taken us up about 200 feet, maybe three, we ran into a blizzard. And it was that cold that we'd hadn't shaved for about a week, I suppose, and The snow was hitting our face and melting and forming icicles on our whiskers. And the horses didn't like going in. We had to go right up to the gate to get into the paddock, and then we had to come down through the paddock because the snow had driven the cattle right down into the bottom corner of the paddock. So we went down, we found the cattle where we reckon they'd be in the corner, and then one of the little rivers up there starts there. It's only a little trickle, the Victoria River, which runs down. And then lead the horses backward and forward so we could drive the cattle across.
And the need for these pristine waters to supply proposed dams unhindered by silt became an urgent concern. Something had to give. The results of Macy Fawcett's experiments were taken seriously, and a local advisory board was set up in 1947.
Macy was the only woman on the Bogong High Plains Advisory Committee. It was that committee that determined the numbers of cattle and the dates on which they would be allowed up and the dates at which they must be taken off. So gradually cattle numbers were reduced as a result of her work.
They started to want to count cattle onto the high tops. You had, you know, how many you were taking out, and they wanted to count them on, and they were restricting the times we could take them out, and all this was the outcome of it.
Whenever animals get into excessive numbers is when they start to cause damage. Mm. You know, I feel for the cattlemen, and they saw it as their right to maintain access to the mountains as part of their family traditions. So I certainly do feel for the cattlemen not being up here anymore, but environmentally, I'm not entirely sure it was sustainable.
So she showed not only that cattle were damaging the vegetation and increasing the soil erosion, they were also contributing in the long run to the non-healing and then regeneration of the grasslands. And I mean, she copped quite a bit of flack because, you know, people didn't want to believe what she was showing.
You wind in and out amongst these enormous gums, twisting and turning them up. Hoofs crackling all the fallen twigs and dropped bark, and the click of their hooves as they hit the rocks and the pebbles and the stones, and sometimes we squelch, and suddenly you come down a narrow little trail and you wind through around a spur, and there in front of you is a beautiful, lush green clearing.
Hey, there's the hut.
Oh. Doesn't look much of a hut, but it's the coziest of places up here, especially when the wind's howling outside and the snow is coming horizontally through some of the vertical cracks in the walls. You've got a roaring fire in there, and campfire sizzling away. Billy of tea standing by.
They're not allowed to take cattle onto the Bogongs now, and haven't done for quite a few years. It's part of my history and background, but I think it is sad myself, yes. I have very fond memories of the high country, and you hear all the birds and hear the different sounds and know what they mean. And I was never lonely, and I suppose the old bushmen were never lonely neither, because they spent all their life there quite happily and contented.
I wonder if Charlie Mack's up at the hut now. Both his parents were dead by the time he reached 10, so he was brought up by his two uncles. They're all great horsemen, all of them. There's some incredible stories about them. They're all very tough, highly regarded amongst the cattlemen. They're an old tradition up there.
Oh, I think somebody's at the hut. They're smoking the chimney.
Okay, come on, listen. That's
enough. Get it.
Oh, here, Christ, I didn't think you were coming.
How long have you been up here?
Been up here 3 days.
What's the weather been like?
Oh, the weather's been beautiful.
Really? Seen any horses around?
Oh, a few, not so many. I think they've been out here and cleaned them up a bit.
Oh, you got your dog with you too?
Oh, yes, no good of being in the bush unless you get your mate. Anyhow, look, come on in and give your horse a bit of feed and come in and I'll just put the billy on.
Charlie McNamara is an enigma, I think. Not anymore, though. I remember when I first came up here, everyone had talked about Charlie Mack, what a fantastic memory he had. He's in his 70s now. They said that you've got to treat him very carefully, he said, because if you do the wrong thing, he might give you a lot of bull dust. But treat him right, you'd get a lot of information from him.
Oh, well, he's my uncle. Of course I spoke to him, but he was a rather difficult man to get along with in many ways. You never knew how to take him, but never mind.
Anyway, how have you been? Oh, not bad for an old fella.
I'd say you're putting on something, man. You dropped chest.
Never mind about that. Tie your horse up and come inside and have a cup of tea.
Right.
I've got the billy boiler. Go on. Pour the tea out.
Righto.
Good out. There's yours, Tor.
Oh, thanks. Nothing like
tea
it.
Tea made with good mountain water.
It hasn't changed much, has it? Last year, just the same.
Oh, yes, a few more names on the wall.
Still got your favourite chair, I see.
Oh, yes, with part of this chair, part of the hut.
Where did it come from? Did you make it?
Well, no, I didn't. It was here when I came here, really, and the old fellow before me, he used to sit on it. That was his chair. And then when he gave up coming here, well, I sat on it.
Who was that?
It was old Jack McNamara. He used to sit on this chair, and there was this piece of wood sticking out here behind me, and he used to go like that, you know, with his head. And he had it all worn away smooth, just like a beast would be rubbing his head up, neck up and down on a bit of wood, you know, to scratch himself, and he had a bit of patch off his hair, and he used to sit here like this, you know.
Old Jack was my third cousin. He was born in about 1898 or something like that. We'd been snowed in. But at that time there was old Jack Mac, Charlie Mac and myself. They used to call me Little Jack.
What is it that you find in the mountains that draws you?
Just the environment and the life and the scenery and the creeks and the little plains, the birds and dingoes howling and the wombats scratching around the hut of a night and seeing a few wild horses, one thing and another, calling your cattle up for salt, watching them grow into money, you know.
Are you ever lonely up here, if you're up here by yourself?
No, never lonely here. I would be lonelier if I was in Melbourne.
Charlie McNamara passed away 8 years later at the age of 82. And the story went that instead of a will, he left a list of people he didn't want at his funeral. By this time, Little Jack was 53 and had left the Hightops to raise his family in suburban Melbourne. Maisie Fawcett went on to become a senior lecturer, but was always remembered for her pioneering fieldwork at a time and in a place where very few women dared to venture.
She loved the area. She loved the work. She'd go out at all hours. I mean, she took it very, very seriously and loved it and didn't want to go back to Melbourne.
So today we're going to descend out of the mountains from the little narrow winding track, the side cut that comes down the hill here through the snow gums and descend back into the woolly butts. And as we get a little bit closer to civilization, the roads start to widen out a little bit. And it's a great descent and you can see the valley, the East Kiwa, follow that along and then back through the stock routes back to the stables.
I love the mountains, I still do love them. I get up there as much as I can, even at my age. Unfortunately, there's not many local people there anymore. All the local people and the local names have gone. And there's something about it, the air and everything seems to give you that great feeling. I don't know what it is. It gets in your blood, I suppose, like living in Northern Territory or somewhere. It gets in your blood.
Big Fella is Watching, the Bogong High Tops, was produced by Ros Bluett with sound engineering by Mark Don. And thanks to botanical historian Lyndon Gilbank, cattleman Jack McNamara, and horse whisperer Clay Baird. Tor Holt's journey was part of the ABC TV program A Big Country, which was broadcast in 1981. Tor passed away in 1994.